In the Forbidden City, a boy of barely 3 years old was lifted onto a golden dragon throne. The entire court fell to their knees. Gongs thundered. Firecrackers cracked across Beijing. He was the son of heaven, emperor of 10,000 years, and his name was Puyi. But imagine this, a child who cried for his nursemaid while ministers bowed and scraped. A toddler imprisoned in palaces of silence. Every whim obeyed, and yet no freedom. He would live to see his dynasty collapse, his empire be stolen from under him, his throne turned to dust. From the dragon throne to a Japanese puppet, to a Soviet prisoner, to a humble gardener sweeping leaves in a Beijing park. His was a life that began in divine splendor and ended in quiet anonymity. The last emperor of China, a man born to rule eternity, who instead lived a half century of humiliation. In 1987, they made a movie called The Last Emperor. It won 9 Oscars. It was Bernardo Bertolucci who put that movie together. And I think he had such rich source material for the story of the man we're about to tell you about. It's an episode of Blind History, and Anthony Medera and I are here to share with you the story of Puyi. Did you know anything about him?
So to be honest, I didn't.
Did you think I was making it up?
Yeah, well, to be honest, no, because you haven't made a lot up. But the last emperor of China, so when I went into it, I mean, it's, you know what happened to China post the last emperor of China. So I think this is a very, it's an interesting part of history. It's a crazy part of history to be on that continent, and it's riches to rags story. You know, so it is very interesting. But no, I did not see the movie.
Well, this is a movie worth seeing. I remember watching. It's long, and there's a lot going on, and you really have to force yourself through some of the middle bits. But it is spectacular in its scope, in the epic scale of all of it. And it starts in the Forbidden City in what is then Peking in China,
which becomes
now Beijing.
Beijing.
Right. And this kid is born in 1906 and takes over as emperor at age 2. He's 2 years old and he's in charge of the most populous country in the world. And some would say one of the most powerful countries in the world. And this is an empire which has lasted all the way from Emperor Qin, who we discussed in another episode, thousands of years
before. So over 2,000 years.
Correct. And here this kid is now in charge. And man, did he choose the wrong time to be born an emperor.
Yeah.
You know, you often think it would be nice to be born an emperor. Not this guy.
No.
Because he grows up in the Forbidden City. The first couple of years are not too bad. I mean, he cries a lot at his coronation ceremony. He's a little baby.
Yeah, he's 2.
Yeah. What would you expect? There are all these people in funny robes. There's loud music, drums. Everyone's bowing in front of him. I don't know any 2-year-old who'd handle that well.
No, of course not. the puppet emperor, yeah.
Yeah, and really he starts off in great turmoil because by 1911, when he's again just a tiny kid, age 6 years old, he has to abdicate. So he has, you know, 4 years of being emperor, horrible to enjoy between the ages of 2 and 6. And then suddenly at 6, you have to abdicate and you're allowed to keep your title. You're allowed to live in the Forbidden City. You have a ceremonial court. You receive a stipend from the government. And of course, this is the government of Sun Yat-sen, right, in 1911. But you're really powerless. So he has to put on a show of being an emperor, even though he's like a curiosity. He's an artifact. He's something left over from an era that is already disappearing. And he starts taking an interest in clocks to bide his time, very literally watching time go by. And he starts wearing Western suits.
So he was educated by a Scotsman, apparently.
Correct.
Is that correct?
A guy called Reginald Johnston, who had a huge influence on him, introduced him to tennis, to cameras, and to anti-Chinese sentiments, which was regarded by people afterwards as being a very bad thing.
Now, but Gareth, just from my side, you know, when I'm looking into it, You know, and it is quite funny, as you mentioned, because he abdicated. So it's almost like he was in control of what he was doing in 1912. So he abdicated, but he had absolutely no clue that he had actually abdicated.
Yeah, he didn't know what was going on. And there's a sad scene in the movie when in 1924, now he's more or less an adult, a teenager at very worst. But there's this very sad scene where he's expelled from the Forbidden City into the world outside. You know, it's almost like someone who's lived in a bubble their whole life and suddenly they have to face the real world. And the scene was of him in tears, clutching a pet dog and not knowing what was going to happen next, where he was going to go, who he was. I mean, you can imagine for anyone, this is frightening, but for someone who's grown up in that hermetically sealed world, this must have been terrifying.
Yeah, and around him, the politics, I think just prior to that, him being sent out of the Forbidden City, I think that there was a general that tried to reinstate the dynasty, and I think that lasted a week or 2 weeks, maybe, at tops. So, I mean, ruthless in the way they used him.
Well, he was just ripe for the taking because this guy really didn't know what to do. I mean, he had delusions of grandeur. He was obsessed with becoming emperor again. But essentially, he was everybody's plaything. And he would be used wherever he was useful and then dumped again when he wasn't. His empress, one wrong.
Yeah.
She became addicted to opium. She was later imprisoned and died in misery. And this is in his early life. And then, of course, he fell under Japanese influence in Manchuria, and he became a useful puppet for them. So they made him emperor, in inverted commas, of Manchukuo, which was a fake state. It never existed. And you've obviously heard of people calling someone a Manchurian candidate.
Yes.
I mean, in this case, this was just a bizarre figurehead. It was a role that didn't signify anything. He was signing decrees that he didn't understand. He was wearing uniforms that he... You know,
there's a lot of pictures of him in those particular at that time.
Yeah, and there were no armies for these uniforms.
Yeah, that was just before Japan was kicked out.
It was made up. It was total nonsense. He was surrounded by spies. He had people watching him all the time. He had a court of sycophants who would pretend that he was important. So, you know, that plays to the ego as well. There were Japanese generals who were making the real decisions behind the scenes. So this poor guy, and I do want to give him some benefit of the doubt here, must have been paranoid, irrelevant, not knowing from day to day what he was required to do, kind of pleasing people some of the time and trying to stand up for himself the rest of the time. It must have been extremely confusing.
Yeah, I put any of his forefathers in this position. You know, it's over 2,000 years that ruled.
Unbelievable.
And suddenly now he has to deal. You know, he might have been equipped to be a great great leader. He never, ever had the opportunity. I think he psychologically, he just was destroyed. I think probably the time what we'd call his third enthronement with the Japanese, that he felt a little bit of how it could be to be an emperor. They treated him very well. They would call him emperor, and I think he was well looked after. And I think at the end, after this, because this is during just prior to the Second World War, and I think post this, I think that's really where it unraveled for him.
Well, the incident probably that turned everything around is at the end of World War II, just while Japan was surrendering, he tried to flee by plane. He had bags of gold and jewels, and he was on an airstrip, and the Red Army captured him. They sent him to Siberia as a prisoner of war, and he was kept there in relative comfort. But, you know, they interrogated him all the time. Mm. God knows what they were trying to get from him. He didn't have any inside info. He was just trying to survive at that point. And then he was sent to the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal in 1946, denied responsibility. And in 1950, the Soviets handed him over to Mao and the People's Republic of China. So the emperor sent back to his homeland as a prisoner. And you cannot tell me that they were going to be nice about this, they were going to treat him decently. I mean, he underwent 9 years of thought reform, which is brainwashing.
Yeah, it's a communist re-education program.
Yeah.
Is what I picked up. and for political prisoners. So he's come out of 10 years under the USSR, and so a prisoner, and maybe he's treated a little bit differently. But and then he goes into he's back in China, and we've covered Mao Zedong.
Not a great guy.
He could get unhinged sometimes.
Well, they made him do all kinds of horrible things. They made him clean toilets. They made him confess his sins daily. They made him denounce imperialism, denounce his family, denounce the history of China. That, you know, at this point, the whole of China was in the process of a cultural revolution where they were actively destroying and erasing anything that came before communism. Mm. And that included the imperial system. And included the whole reason that he came to be, his family.
But why do you think Mao Zedong didn't kill him?
I think he was also, again, a useful symbol. Because after he had been brainwashed and re-educated, as you put it, he was, you know, educated to be this useless guy who had conformed to Marxism. So Marxism wins. And here's the proof. We've got an emperor, a former emperor who's now just an ordinary communist worker like the rest of you. So, you know, in some ways, he was a living relic of China's past. In other ways, he was this useful common man who had been transformed by the brilliance of Chinese Maoism.
And then Gareth, he wrote this book when he was actually during his imprisonment. So the question always comes up, how did that book survive, you know, from emperor to citizen? Maybe, like you say, the rhetoric could be that, look at this, it's following the Marxist way, as you mentioned. But, you know, that's a surprising thing for me. And I think the movie is based, pulls a lot of facts from his autobiography.
Well, what you got to remember about the book, you ask, how was it ever published? It was supervised by the state.
Okay.
So everything that he wrote, they checked, edited, changed. So you'll see in the book, and I haven't read it, but I've seen excerpts of it, and it's hugely complimentary to Mao. It's hugely complimentary about the Chinese Revolution. It's full of rhetoric about how great the common working man is and how evil imperialism is. So you can see that they were using this as an opportunity to propagandize. But in 1962, it's not all bad. He did marry a nurse. That was arranged by the Communist Party. They chose a wife for him. It was his fifth wife, by the way. And he eventually died just a couple of years later, 1967, and he died of kidney cancer. The saddest part of this, I think, for many people who watch the movie and who are interested in this man's life, is he was buried in a grave with a whole lot of other people. He didn't get to choose who was buried next to him. Nothing fancy. He's got a normal, just his name. Puyi, no emperor. The last Chinese emperor, you know how the first Chinese emperor was buried. Mm. I mean, we've got the terracotta warriors, yes. and this underground mausoleum, which they still haven't excavated and they're afraid to. It's so big that it's a man-made pyramid underground. And the last emperor is buried like a pauper.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
But did he have children?
No. No, I think that the medical, the general consensus about his physical condition was that he was impotent. He'd never really had successful relationships with anybody because he was just treated so differently and then suddenly treated so much the same as everyone else. I don't think he really ever had a serious relationship with anyone. I mean, we talk about these wives, but they came and went. He had the fifth of them was in 1962. So he never had kids. That line has ended.
Oh, that's the end of it. So
that's it.
And I suppose they wouldn't have, more than likely, I don't know what would have happened to any of his offspring.
Well, if he'd had descendants, they probably would have been subjected to misery as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the saddest story. And, you know, he had no government experience, but he imagined he was an emperor. He was paranoid and isolated. It was a tragedy, but at the same time as it was a farce, because you have this boy king who's then turned into a puppet, then a prisoner, then just a proletarian worker.
And you know how he was obviously well-educated and he was doing the gardens.
Yeah, that's right.
And just imagine how, you know, that is also sad in that he's, you know, I mean, he's not using any of his learnings in his life to just...
Because he was in Beijing at a certain time doing the gardens, as you mentioned, there's the story which they say is true. He had been so brainwashed that people who recognized him from the 1910s, you know, from even before that, while he was a baby emperor, some people would recognize him, particularly older Chinese people. They would bow, and he'd been so brainwashed, he didn't understand what this meant.
Wow.
And he said of himself, "I had all the trappings of power, but none of the power. I was a ruler of shadows." Incredible story. The last emperor of the Qin dynasty, the last monarch of imperial China, the last divine ruler on earth, arguably.
And he did, there's just some stories about when he would go and visit as a tourist the old palace.
Oh yeah.
And there was a picture on the wall, and the person that was giving the tour would explain what it is, and he disagreed. That is not the emperor. But in fact, that's Prince Chun. And then, "You don't know what you're talking about, da 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 da," the person would say to him. He says, "I should know, that's my father."
Sure. Wow. Wow.
Sure.
So again, just this tragic, tragic story, and shows you how politics can affect even the mighty and reduce them to nothing.
Yeah.
Extraordinary stuff. Well, there will be more episodes of Blind History. Anthony Medder and I love doing this. We hope you're loving it too. Like, subscribe, give us some feedback. We would love to hear from you. And you will hear the next episode in just a while.